Okay, I'm going to get started if I may. Well done getting your essays in today. The next hurdle, of course, is the exam, and there'll be a session about that next week. The exam is, as you will already know, on the 3rd of June at 9:30 in the morning, and you pick up the paper a week ahead. And I'm not going to try and anticipate what Andy Webb says to you next week, but what I'll say is that there's a certain merit in exam conditions, in like the merit of a race. There's so much you can prepare, but the actual occasion and the feeling of writing against the clock introduces its own creativity and improvisation. So don't try to memorize two essays in advance. It'll kill it dead. Try to get some of that spontaneity of an unprepared exam, and above all, don't worry about it. You've all learnt a lot over the past 6 months. I can see from seminars and from talking to people, 6 months, 8 months, however long it is, and I hope you have that feeling of a sort of body of material that you've worked through, that you've got on your shelves, and of ideas as well as authors that you're now a bit less unfamiliar with than you were when you arrived here at the beginning of October. I want today to talk about what I've called writing rather than writing space or writing gender or subject-based approaches to writing. And so my focus is on style and rhythm and the actual musical qualities, in a way, of a text, as well as those aspects where a text seems to be either commenting on itself or totally dependent on itself, so that it is all you need to understand it. And perhaps you can't understand it in the sense of paraphrasing it or saying this is what it's about, because it is it, the poem, the play, the piece of fiction. And I'll give you some examples as I go on. But I want to start just with a novella by Ian McEwan called On Chesil Beach, which you may or may not have read. It's not a set text, obviously, and you're not expected to know it. But it's relevant for a couple of reasons. It's relevant to NMW in sort of obvious ways, because it has strong elements of social historical contextualization in the 1950s when it's set. And the actions and the feelings have roots in their upbringings and in their educations, so there's that formative historical aspect too that's relevant to NMW. For example, Edward, who's in the partnership, is educated as a historian, and he has in his mind the conflict in thinking about history between a Marxist determinism, saying that social forces are everything and the individual can do more or less nothing to deflect them, and on the other hand, a strong sense of individualism, that individuals and how they behave and how they're prompted to behave at a given moment can affect everything. And the novel is to some extent a debate about those issues, and also a debate about the differences between the two characters. But it is a novella, and in it a number of things happen and a number of things don't happen. Just to think about the sort of background to this, I think I said in the very first lecture of the module that you can't really have abstract writing in the way that you can have abstract painting, because as soon as you put words down on the page, they carry with them associations. And even if you put the words together in a way that doesn't seem to make any consecutive or argumentative or narrative sense, those words intrinsically carry associations. And you may remember that I gave you a Tristan Tzara poem as an illustration of that, and showed how you could actually derive interpretations from what, on the face of things, is nonsensical. But there are other aspects which are to do with tension and rhythm. And they apply in that poem, and they also apply in Chesil Beach. Now, On Chesil Beach is narrated in the third person. It has an impartial narrator, and it has four main narrative lines. First of all, there's the situation that's moving forward between this young couple, as seen by the narrator. Secondly, Interwoven with that are the thoughts and anxieties and reactions in that young relationship of Edward. And third, the thoughts, anxieties, and reactions of Florence. And fourthly, there's a series of flashbacks, although flashbacks suggest the wrong kind of idea. It suggests something too rapid. They're quite long, meditative reflections on different stages in their relationship and indeed on their lives before their relationship, so that through the narrative, you get the whole of their lives up to then. And eventually you get the whole of their lives after then. And then is their wedding night and what happens and doesn't happen that night. Now, so far, if you like, so conventional, and so far, so conventional also is the fact that there's a sort of double pressure, and I think this is an interesting thing about how fiction works often. The double pressure is, on the one hand, wanting to turn the page, wanting to know what happens. That's the kind of narrative plot suspense pressure which is, on the whole, deprecated by the great modernists and by literary theorists, because it suggests something sort of slightly primitive or even childlike, what happens next. You remember that quotation I gave you when I was talking about Morm from E.M. Forster, who said, a story, oh dear, yes, a novel has to tell a story, as if that's the last thing he wanted to do. I'd like to say that I think that the story is very important in fiction. It always has been and always will be. And that those fictions which rebel against narrative drive are dependent on it all the same. That's to say, it's only by knowing that that's at some level what you want that you can see what's happening in a novel that deliberately withholds it. So there's that pressure, wanting to turn the page. And against that is the pressure of backstory, of insight into character and thought processes, and this is what I'm stressing in this lecture today, just the sheer quality of the writing, how the words work with each other, which make you want to slow down and ponder and think and savour the lines as you read them. And it's that double pressure, wanting to crack on and at the same time wanting not to, that I think is a crucial element of the art of all kinds of writing, but particularly fiction. Now, just without giving anything away about On Chesil Beach, in case you haven't read it, the book has 166 pages, and 160 of those are concerned with the single evening, the marriage night of this couple, and their memories and reflections and flashbacks from that night. The final six pages tell you everything else that is going to happen in their lives in a coda. Now, coda is a word I've chosen deliberately. It's a musical term, and it means, technically it's Italian, like a lot of musical terms in classical music, it means a tale. McEwan is, as some novelists have been, James Joyce is another example, extremely interested in music and knowledgeable about it. He knows a lot about rock music, he also knows a lot about classical music. And of his two characters in On Chesil Beach, Edward is mainly interested in, and in a not terribly discerning way, in rock music. His girlfriend, and now his wife, Florence, is a classical musician. And one of the things that happens early on is that we learn, as in this quotation in the handout on page one, Edward had never cared for classical music, but now he was learning its sprightly argot, its slang, its technical vocabulary. Legato, pizzicato, con brio. Legato means tied and therefore flowing. Pizzicato means the opposite of that, sort of plucked. And con brio means with vehemence and energy. Slowly, through brute repetition, he was coming to recognize and even like certain pieces. There was one she played with her friends that especially moved him. And so it goes on to talk about how he comes to the sort of music she likes through her, and how she herself is at her best and at most herself when she's playing. As you see at the end of that paragraph, She held herself gracefully with back straight and head lifted proudly and read the music with a commanding, almost haughty expression that stirred him. That look had such certitude, such knowledge of the path to pleasure. When the business was music, she was always confident and fluid in her movements, rosining a bow, restringing her instrument, and so on. But in the rest of her life, she was surprisingly clumsy and unsure, forever stubbing a toe or knocking things over or bumping her head. I'm going to go on now to other writers and talk about the actual quality of the writing and the sound of the writing and the rhythms and how they work. But you can see they're already being set up something which tells you through the rhythms and through the vowel music something about these characters, and it gives you some intimations of what may or may not be about to happen. Let me now move to a different kind of example from theatre. And we're extremely lucky to have some student actors who are going to perform for us under Emma Jane's direction here. We've got Lucy and Francesca and Isabel who are going to perform from Come and Go, but I just want to say a couple of words about the play before they do. I want to talk about Beckett a little bit. Now, in any consideration of where what art does merges with what it is, theatre obviously has a special place. Theatre, like the other aspects of what you've been working on, depends to some degree on words, but it can't exist solely with words, as you found out when you did those workshops, if you didn't already know. The actual immediacy of the performance and the ways in which the performance interprets the words are themselves important. The contiguity of audience and actors are important. The fact that you have to follow it in its time, you can't hurry up a play, you have to go along with it, whereas with your reading you can go at your pace and you can put things down and pick them up. All those things matter. But there's also a sense in which the meanings come through what is actually depicted in front of you. And before we turn to Come and Go, I want to give you an example which is called Breath. Perhaps a useful prelude to this can be found in Harold Pinter's words on Godot on the handout at the top of page one. This is interesting in part because Harold Pinter hadn't yet seen Godot, but a friend had written to him and described it to him and asked him what he made of it. And he wrote back in 1955, "The course of the play, its texture and its characters sound undeniable, undeniable. But is it Beckett's business to answer questions he himself poses? I don't see that. It seems to me that as he doesn't answer his question, his message can only be that he, for one, cannot see or is not prepared to hazard an answer. In other words, surely the sole and necessary answer to the question is the play itself. If the question were answered explicitly, the question would cease to exist. It would be consumed in the answer. There would be no impulse, no work, no play. Both in Beckett and Kafka, surely, you get all the questions and any answer you want off any shelf in any permutation, according to your taste and disposition. I prefer the term gutache, a major irritation, a most stern and ruthless activity without question or answer, a necessity. The necessity to what? The necessity to say. To say what? Whatever's to be said. It is to be said. It is said. Some people say it better than others." In other words, paraphrasing, trying to dig out meanings, what Keats, long before in the Romantic period, called the irritable search after fact and reason, are not all there is to literature, and in some cases can get in the way of it. Now, Breath, which you've got in its entirety below the Pinter hand, quotation on the handout, bottom right-hand corner of page one. Curtain goes up, faint light on stage littered with miscellaneous rubbish. Hold about 5 seconds. Faint brief cry and immediately inspiration, breathing in. And slow increase of light together, reaching maximum together in about 10 seconds. Silence and hold about 5 seconds. Expiration, breathing out. And slow decrease of light together, reaching minimum together in about 10 seconds and immediately cry as before. Silence and hold about 5 seconds. That's the end of the play. The play you're going to see in a minute, Beckett subtitled A Dramatic Cure, which kind of implies a ridiculous drama or a little drama or something between a drama and a reticule, which is a handbag, something that contains something. And this is another dramatic cure in all those senses, but one which, while on the one hand risible and comic, is also as much a summary of life as that quotation from Godot, they give birth the stride of a grave, the light gleams for an instant, then it's night once more. Something to bear in mind reading that text, as compared with seeing it performed, is that there are things that you can't do in a dramatic performance, just as there are some things you can't do on the page. Those words inspiration and expiration are crucial to that. What you hear, if you are watching breath, is and then breathing out. There's no other way you can do it. But of course, if you see the word inspiration, it means something else too. It means something to do with art and all that inspiration means. And expiration can mean death, as well as breathing out, or it can mean something coming to the end of its sell-by date. It expires in that sense. So that already there are complexities in the written word that aren't there in the performance. And now I'm going to ask you whether you think there's anything similar to that in Come and Go. Off you go.
what came before? Shall we hold hands in the old way? I can feel the rain.
Thank you very much indeed. Terrific pauses apart from everything else. And immediately, I mean, since I saw that being rehearsed before, all kinds of nuances of character have come through there, of individual character, which bring it to life in all sorts of ways. But interestingly, if you look at Beckett's stage directions, which are on page 2 of the handout, are not what he wanted. And one of the issues that's very fascinating in relation to text and interpretation is the degree of freedom the interpreter has. It's tempting to say that in the theater, there's more freedom because the actors are there and the director's there and they're all a team with the writer making something. But of course, if you're reading a text in the privacy of your room or in the garden or wherever it is, you and how you are reacting with the text aren't making your own interpretations. You're visualizing characters and actions and so on. You see that Beckett, first of all, wants certain costumes, drab, nondescript hats with enough brim to shade the faces. Hands made up to be as visible as possible, no rings apparent. He wants as little visible as possible, shouldn't be clear what they're sitting on. They shouldn't be seen to go off stage, they should just disappear from the lighted area. The O's should be 3 very different sounds as they were, but the voices should be as low as compatible with audibility, colorless except for the 3 O's. Now, it's for you to decide whether how Emma Jane has directed that is preferable to what Beckett has in his stage directions. And perhaps particularly importantly, what it is that Beckett is up to here with these stage directions. Because an irony of his work is that he moved out of prose fiction into writing for the theatre, an area where arguably he had less control. And in doing so, started to impose more and more control through his writing of stage directions on how the thing might be performed, but actually without managing to prevent the creativity of directors and actors. Just to fill you in on a little bit of background here, in case you don't know, Beckett's first text, you remember Beckett worked as a secretary to James Joyce. His first texts were experimental novels, beginning with one in 1934, so he spans the pre-war and the war and the post-war period. 1934, More Pricks Than Kicks, and Murphy in 1938. And then What, which was written during the Second World War, not published until 1953, that's W-A-T-T, What, a name, to his trilogy, Molloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable, all written in the 1940s. Around the same time, in fact, as he was beginning to work on Waiting for Godot. Instead, the question of who is Godot, just a sort of tiny PS, or footnote rather. A friend of mine who wrote a book about racing bicycling, but is also highly literate and keen on Beckett, found that there was a famous French cyclist called Godot, EAU, Godot. GODEAU, and that Beckett had once been outside the famous Vélodrome near Paris where the cyclists race and had said to some kids who were waiting outside, what you doing? And they said, on attend Godot. They were waiting for Godot, the famous racing cyclist, to turn up. And the theory is that stuck in his mind as a possible title for a play. Anyway, back to Beckett and to come and go, and some questions. The first line of the play is, when did we three last meet? Ring any bells? Macbeth, first line of Macbeth, which is, when shall we three meet again? So already the play is sort of touching on other plays in the same way as Eliot's poems touch on other poems. And we are taken into a world of theatre and a world in which perhaps this is a turning around of Macbeth. Perhaps this is all about Macbeth in some sort of way. The last words of the play are, I can feel the rings. But you remember there's that stage direction, no rings visible. So then we have to make up our mind what this is about. We know that they're dreaming of love, or they have been dreaming of love when they were girls, that they're now old. And in the symmetry of the play, they all know things about each other that the other didn't know. And they've all got something terrible or surprising or shocking that's occurred to them in their lives. The fact that there are no rings visible suggests that they're not married, although they started out young, sitting on the log, dreaming of love. What are these rings? Are they rings that they once wore, that they gave each other, that their boyfriends gave them at that time of engagements that were broken off? Are they the rings somehow of the log, which a log gets a new ring, a new layer of bark every year? Is it something to do with the way in which trees grow and time passes? All kinds of questions there, which actually Beckett doesn't answer, and we can't answer. It goes back to what Harold Pinter said, that the thing exists in and of itself and for itself. Shall we see it once more? Would that be, sort of fix it in your minds and give you something to... So, do you mind doing it once more? Great, thank you.
Not been told. God forbid.
Well, thanks once again very much. And I suppose one thing that one can say immediately is how the play introduces all the melancholy and loss and frustrated hope of three lifetimes, all the disorderliness of things not working out, and at the same time makes something which is beautifully symmetrical and perfect and a tiny work of art out of it, in which all the movements are matched by all the other movements, and in which at the end there's that opening up of a kind of flower with the hands being held in a gesture of whatever you want to interpret it to mean. Let me turn now to a poem which seems in a similar way sort of self-complete and unparaphrasable. This is William Carlos Williams's poem, The New Clouds, on page 2 of the handout. The morning that I first loved you had a quality of fine division about it, a lightness and a light full of small round clouds, all rose upon the ground which bore them, a light of words upon a paper sky, each a meaning and all a meaning jointly. It was a quiet speech, at ease but reminiscent, and of praise with a disturbance of waiting. Yes, a page that glowed by all that it was not, a meaning more of meaning than the text whose separate edges were the edges of the sky. Now, this works almost independently of what the words are saying, like a piece of music. If you just look at the first line, you'll see that no vowel sound is repeated in that line. Every vowel sound is different from the other. And that's almost the same in the second line, although there's some repetition of the short it vowel and of the had from that in the first line. But the fact that you get such a subtle variety of vowels means that you're on the lookout for moments when vowels are repeated or when whole words are repeated. And mixed up with that is something that's connected to the double pressure I was talking about earlier on in fiction, which is to do with the fact that the line endings are somehow necessary where they are, and it, at the same time, everything in the sense is trying to break over the line breaks. The morning that I first loved you had a quality of fine division about it, a lightness and a light full of small round clouds, and so on. You could read it like prose, although it would be different if you did. Once you start to be made in this quiet way alert to both rhythm and line break and repetition or non-repetition of vowels, you're particularly alert to the fact that the word meaning is almost immediately repeated and is again going to come twice towards the end, which is paradoxical given that when you come on that word, you realize that you don't really know what the meaning of the poem is. And in a sense, perhaps you don't really care. You know it's something to do with somebody remembering when he first fell in love. It has that in common with come and go. And something to do with the weather and something to do with a poem. But actually, to summarize all that would be to spoil it. It would be to crudify it, oversimplify it. It's also, in a sense, about poetry, a meaning more of meaning than the text whose separate edges were the edges of the sky. I suppose if you want to figure out what that means, you could try cutting out the poem and lying on the grass in the sun and reading the poem, because then the edges would be the edges of the sky, if you see what I mean. The thing causing the poem not to be a poem would be the sky around it. And I guess it's some sort of situation like that that is being evoked. But the separate edges in themselves again draw attention to the question, why do you have the line breaks where you have the line breaks? And one definition of poetry, a very simple one, but actually pretty much infallible, is that it's a kind of writing in which where the line ends is determined by the writer rather than by the width of the page. Kind of writing where width of the line is determined by the writer rather than by the width of the page. So the poem doesn't say something, well, it says a lot of things, but it is what it is. And I've given you a little quotation about that on the page 4 of the handout, Clive Wilmer writing about the poet and critic Donald Davy, where he says, "The meaning of a poem is not something detached from it, an interpretation we offer to the language, but something that grows in the experience of reading, and not just of understanding the words, but undergoing the drama of their disposition, the juxtapositions, the cadences, the line endings, the expected or unexpected chimes, the satisfaction or frustration of rhythmic expectations." I'll go on to another poem in a moment, but I want you to keep those words in mind whenever you're tempted to say what William Carlos Williams is trying to say here, or what Beckett means here is, because those formulations imply that you know what they were somehow catastrophically failing to communicate, but you can somehow bring it to birth through your paraphrase. There may be instances where you feel you know better than the writer, but be careful in using those formulations. Here's a very different poem, and a much more formally constructed one, by Elizabeth Bishop. If I can find it, yeah, it's on page 3 of the handout, and it's called One Art. It's a villanelle, and if you don't know what a villanelle is here, I'll tell you. There are five. A villanelle has five stanzas of 3 lines each, plus a final quatrain. 3 lines times 5, plus a stanza of 4. It only has 2 rhymes all the way through, A-B-A, B-A-B. The first and the third lines of the first stanza are repeated or echoed alternately in stanzas 2 to 4, as a refrain. The first and the third lines of the first stanza are repeated or echoed alternately in stanzas 2 to 4 as a refrain. So you've got "The art of losing isn't hard to master" at the end of stanza 2. "None of these will bring disaster," stanza 3. "The art of losing isn't hard to master," stanza 4. "I miss them, it wasn't a disaster," so on. Those 2 lines, possibly modified, become the last 2 lines of the poem. So much for the very, very tight formal structure of the poem, as tight as the structure that Beckett makes a diagram of in his stage directions for Come and Go, the diagram of the hands and the diagram of the movements of the characters. Everything is absolutely perfect and tight. Let me just read it briefly. "The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of 3 loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost 2 cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I owned, 2 rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it like disaster." Now, it seems perfectly clear what this poem is saying, but of course it's ironic. It's saying the opposite of what it's saying. For example, you couldn't act on the advice lose something every day, because if you tried to lose something, you'd remember where you'd left it, and you wouldn't have lost it. And there's a kind of augmentation or escalation in terms of the seriousness of what she describes having lost, her mother's watch, houses, and then, as if in a fairy tale, continents and cities and rivers that she's owned, which must mean that losing you, whoever you is or was, is the biggest thing she could conceivably have lost, bigger than all those other things which have been getting bigger and bigger. And the stakes are, so the stakes are increased, and as the stakes are increased, so the absolutely perfect control of the poem, of the form of the poem, of the villanelle, very, very subtly is eroded. There's a warning in that dash that interrupts the flow at the beginning of the final stanza, and the parenthesis. And then that hesitation and repetition, it may look like, write it. She's saying she can't write it, but she's making herself write it. Look like disaster. And what she's been saying, of course, all the way through is, it's no disaster. It isn't a disaster. It's no disaster. Won't do you any harm. Practice it. Lose something every day. But by the end, she's saying it is a disaster. Certainly looks like a disaster. In poetry, Christopher Ricks has written, form is not a framework. Is not a framework, but an instrument of research. It's through the form and through the rhythms and through the music that you find out what it is you want to say. Now, there are examples of prose where that's true too. I'm not going to spend any time on the Joyce quotation on page 3, which is very familiar to you, and if it's not, it should be, and you should read it and think about it. It is, of course, from Stephen Dedalus's own point of view. But just briefly to show how, and this goes on from Dimitar's fascinating meditation on the relations between character and space and character and place in his lecture last week. An episode in Mrs. Dalloway where one of the things that happens through the use of words and thoughts is fantasy, is in other words the creation of what of a kind of individual work of art in making the person in the surroundings. The person becomes a novel as well as a character in a novel. The illustration I'm giving is a relatively unimportant seeming one. We've got, of course, several main characters in Mrs. Dalloway, not only Mrs. Dalloway herself, but Retsia Warren-Smith and her husband Septimus. And there's a very strong outer life in terms of the party that's going to happen, in terms of what's happening in the London streets, and in Septimus's memories of the First World War and all the damage that the First World War has done to him, which will result in his suicide. But it's also the novel and essay in subjectivism. It's about point of view, and it's about what goes on in different people's minds and how, to some extent, that is devoid of objective reality. It's purely conjured up through the imagination. Peter Walsh is just wandering around, you remember, and he sees a girl crossing Trafalgar Square, and he's attracted to her, and he has this idea that perhaps he might offer her an ice cream. But I think we can regard that as some kind of version of something else he may have in mind. Anyway, he follows her, and for quite a long way, she had crossed Oxford Street and Great Portland Street. So they've gone from Trafalgar Square, Piccadilly Circus, round the edges of Soho. She had crossed Oxford Street and Great Portland Street and turned down one of the little streets. And now, the great moment was approaching, for now she slackened, opened her bag, and with one look in his direction, but not at him, one look that bade farewell, summed up the whole situation and dismissed it triumphantly forever, had fitted her key, opened the door, and gone. It was over. Well, I've had my fun. I've had it, he thought, and it was smashed to atoms, his fun, for it was half made up, as he knew very well, invented, this escapade with the girl, made up as one makes up the better part of life, he thought, making oneself up, making her up, creating an exquisite amusement and something more. You see how it's entirely a little novel in itself and about the creation of a little novel. And another example of that, and this is where Virginia Woolf begins to influence the new self-referential novelists of the post-war period, whom we haven't had time to focus on in the module. But she's linked with Kafka in anticipating them. Here is Kafka, the men running past, it's in the selection Metamorphosis and Other Stories that I have anyway, and it's complete, just as Come and Go is complete in itself. And it begins with the word if, just as If This Is a Man has a title which introduces that uncertainty. If This Is a Man invites the question, well, what if not? And Italo Calvino's 1950s fiction, If on a Winter's Night a Traveller, which begins, the text begins, you are just about to read a novel called If on a Winter's Night a Traveller. And here is the men running past. If we happen to be walking along a street at night and a man visible already from afar because the street inclines gently uphill in front of us and there's a full moon comes running towards us, then we will not grab hold of him, even if he's feeble and ragged, even if someone is running after him, yelling, but rather we will let him run on unmolested, for it is night. And it's not our fault that the street in front of us in the moonlight night is on an incline, and moreover, it is possible that the two men have devised their chase for their own amusement. Perhaps they're both in pursuit of a third man. Perhaps the first of them is being unjustly pursued. Perhaps the second means to kill him, and we would become accessory to his murder. Perhaps the two of them don't know the first thing about one another, and each one is just running home to bed on his own account. Perhaps they're two somnambulists. Perhaps the first of them is carrying a weapon. And finally, may we not be tired, and have we not had a lot of wine to drink? We are relieved not to see the second man. He's conjured up, hasn't he, an extraordinary mixture, on the one hand, of possible eventualities and dramas in a tiny space, and also a replication of the thought processes which actually create inaction amid a story which, in a few lines, is all about action. And in so doing, has caught you up in such a way that you've started to visualize it yourself and think something is going on. And there's a particular key there, a particular trick. It's not just the if, which we tend to forget, but even if he's feeble and ragged, this is lines 5, I think, even if someone is running after him, that's got an if. But by the next paragraph, we're kind of assuming the second man is there, chasing the first man, and indeed by halfway down there maybe they're both chasing a third man, so the story is kind of proliferating in front of our eyes until it deflates itself at the end and says we're relieved not to see the second man. So it's only actually been about one man, if it's been about anything at all, rather than what goes on in the process of writing itself. I hope you can follow the train of thought there without my spelling it out, rather in the same way as I'm inviting you not necessarily to feel you've got to spell out everything that you have read for this module. But I just want to turn in a couple of minutes that are left to a different question, which is not about style and not about fantasy, but is about the kinds of writing I've left out, which are quite clearly about something, paraphrasable, important, political or social, or to do with relations between the sexes. And what happens in style, in relation to style, when content, to make this crude distinction, and you all know, not least from Dimitar's lecture, how impossible it is to arrange these gig lamps or these separate shelves separately. But think about Ngugi, for example, In a Grain of Wheat. And what happens to style there? He is overwhelmingly, isn't he, trying to get across a story about independence, about Kenyan independence. And for the moment, he's chosen to do it in a language not his own, but which will reach the largest possible readership. People in the Anglophone West, but also people in Kenya who've been brought up and educated in English. So it's got these biblical echoes and literary echoes that come from the English-created education system in Kenya. So there's that extreme irony that in talking about decolonization and rejecting the colonizers, the novel is using the style, the narrative methods, and the language of the colonizer. After that, as you know, Ngugi, from the lecture, Ngugi rejected English as the medium of communication and said, you've got to write in your own home language, because otherwise there's too heavy an irony there. But even that repudiation, he wrote in English. Now, what would have happened? The style of A Grain of Wheat is, I think you would agree, unexperimental. It's, in fact, deeply traditional. It's as if he's taking on, he's saying, I'm going to give you a really traditional piece of writing, but about a different subject, a new subject. Should he have found an experimental way to approach his new subject? Could he have used English in a new way that would have corresponded to the newness of the situation that he's trying to describe? Or, on the contrary, is there an essential difficulty if you have something which you want to, which carries a message that you want people clearly to understand and to take away and learn from, that the writing can't be an end in itself. The writing has to be a medium. And therefore, stylistic experimentation has to be put on the back burner or ignored altogether. That's just, I wanted to leave you with that question because it goes against everything I've been talking about before. But what I'm hoping that you can do in all the different things you will be doing to revise and to think about the text you've been reading before the exam is to think about the writing. These people have put these words down in a particular way, in a particular order, chosen particular words rather than other words. Why have they done that? And what's the effect of their choices? Okay, thanks very much and good luck with the exam.